Chapter 9. After a long time staring at the information on the laptop, Stiles stands and stretches, gathers his things, and they head back out to the Jeep. The no-one-goes-out-alone rule has been reinstated, much to everyone's dismay, although nobody has argued. Derek's is the best place for sleepovers, because there just isn't enough room to sleep in a wolf pile at anyone else's. It was a tight fit even before they started adding members to the pack. They still sleep at Stiles or at Scott's sometimes, but most often, if they're all going to be in one place, it's at Derek's. While Stiles morosely informs the pack of his lack of progress, he's not expecting anything beyond some sympathetic comments. He's certainly not expecting a breakthrough, but that's what he gets, and it comes, of all people, from Boyd. The teenager looks up from where he's proofreading an essay for his English class and says, "Can you maybe look up the transaction at Starbucks?" "What transaction?" Stiles asks, frowning. "Wi-Fi at that Starbucks isn't exactly free," Boyd says. He sees Stiles blinking at him and says, "Okay, look, I know that place. It's two blocks down from the dance studio where Lakeisha and Keely have their lessons. Last year, since my dad was working swing shift all the time, Mom stayed home with Trey and Will and I took the girls to dance. It wasn't worth going all the way back home, so I would just walk down to the Starbucks and sit for an hour. It was like my weekly treat to myself. I'd get a coffee and play on the internet on that junky old laptop that Dad got me for Christmas." "Okay," Stiles says. "So?" "So, they had a lot of trouble with people in nearby apartment buildings leeching off their Wi-Fi," Boyd says, "and they started changing the password every day. They'll only give it to you if you actually purchase something." "So what?" Derek asks. "People don't pay with credit cards for a dollar cup of coffee." Several people let out snorts of laughter. "Dude, when was the last time you set foot in a Starbucks?" Scott asks. "Or bought anything besides a plain cup of coffee. The cheapest drink on their menu has to be at least $2.50. Derek makes a face. "Still," he says, "this guy pays for hotel rooms with cash. Why would he pay for coffee with a credit card?"
"He doesn't expect us to even know about these emails," Lydia points out. "He has no reason to think Dr. Deaton would show them to us."
"It's a long shot," Stiles agrees, "but it's worth a try." The alternative, he knows, is to stake out the Starbucks. He doesn't want to do that for several reasons. The first is that he has no idea when the warlock might show up again, and he has little things like school and lacrosse, which would make it extremely difficult. Secondly, if said warlock saw him there, it would make their confrontation very public, and therefore very dangerous. A lot of innocents would be caught in the crossfire. He needs to find a way to make that not happen, so he takes out his phone and dials his father. "Hey, Dad, can you do me a favor?" "Are we going to reach an agreement about egg white omelets?" his father asks.
"What, like how they have no flavor?" Stiles replies.
"It'll do for a start. What do you need?" Stiles explains the situation and asks if he can get the list of transactions from the Starbucks for each of those 3 days. His father hedges a little. It's a long shot, and technically he's not entitled to it since the sorcerer hasn't committed to a prosecutable crime, and there'll be a lot of information on those lists about people who aren't involved. Stiles lets him lodge all his protests and eventually come to a conclusion that a long shot is better than no shot. "It won't be until tomorrow," he says. "That's okay," Stiles says. "I have a history test to study for, and the last 8 chapters of A Passage to India to get through. Life goes on."
"La-dee-da," his father agrees, and they say goodbye.
All of it will have to wait until after his detention, since he doubts Harris is going to let him work on anything productive while he's there. He shows up less than 2 minutes after the last bell of the day rings and just takes a seat at one of the tables in Harris's classroom without a word.
Harris sneers at him, then swallows when Derek just looks at him, not betraying any aggression, but still managing to be quite menacing. Less than 2 minutes after that, the rest of the pack shows up. They don't even say anything to Harris, but just start arranging themselves at tables. Harris gives them a startled look, then snaps, "What are all of you doing here?" "Serving detention," Allison says with her usual perky smile. "I didn't give you detention." "Would you like us to make you?" Erica asks, and without further warning or challenge at all, pulls the bottom of her shirt up, flashing him. Styles chokes on his own spit. After that, Harris doesn't seem to have much to say about them serving detention, or anything at all, for that matter. He just sits down at his desk and stares down at a lesson plan without ever moving his pen. Styles pulls his phone into his lap and texts Erica with, "You know he's gonna fap to that tonight, right?" "Totally worth it," she texts back, "since he knows he'll never get any of this." Styles bites his lip to keep from laughing and goes back to doing his homework. He figures, given how long Harris is likely to make him stay in detention, he can make a sizable dent in it and not have to worry about it over the weekend. He'll have enough to do. At least over the weekend, parents are less apt to kick up a fuss about the number of slumber parties. Harris keeps them until 4:30, then snaps that they can leave. Erica just gives him a coy smile as she flounces out of the room. "But I'll be watching that dog," he adds after Styles. "I wonder what it's like," Styles says thoughtfully, as they head across the parking lot. "What's what like?" Isaac asks. "What it's like to have so much free time and so few problems that harping on some traumatized teenager about their service dog is a viable pastime." Several people let out laughter at this. Styles decides to celebrate having lived through the week by going through the drive-thru on the way home, and they buy epic amounts of food that is extremely bad for them. Even Lydia will loosen up to have a double bacon cheeseburger on occasion, now that she knows the wolf will keep her fit. He's a little disconcerted when he comes home to find his father in the living room with several manila folders full of paper. "Hey, that smells good," he says when they come in. "It's not for you," Styles says, trying to hide the bag behind him. "What are you doing here?" Sheriff Stilinski arches an eyebrow at him. "I live here," he says. But work!" "I came home to bring you those financial records you wanted," Stilinski says. "You're welcome." Styles droops. He knows when he's defeated. "Thanks, Dad," he says, and his father ruffles his hair before taking the bag out of his hands and pulling out a cheeseburger. It's a good thing they always order more than enough, since hungry wolves can eat as many as 4 burgers in one sitting. He makes a face and sits down with his own order of chicken nuggets and fries. Then he views the stack of paper. "Geez, you're such a Luddite." "Those aren't yours, you idiot," Stilinski says. "They're for a different case." He holds up a jump drive and says, "This is for you." "Oh, cool. Thanks." Styles sits down and takes out his laptop. Stilinski shakes his head and gathers up his papers and heads back out the door to work, snagging a thing of onion rings on his way by. Styles sighs but doesn't protest. There are 3 files on this drive, 1 for each day. Each one is an Excel spreadsheet, which he opens. "Christ, a lot of people drink Starbucks in this town," he says. "There are thousands of transactions here." "Well, that's the entire day," Lydia says, leaning over his shoulder. "Limited by time. It's not like he would have bought a coffee, sat around for 3 hours, and then sent an email." "He could have come back later, or even used their Wi-Fi from home if he lives close enough. Boyd said they had a problem with the nearby apartments." Styles cuts himself off and forces himself to be rational. "Start with the most likely possibilities. Occam's razor applies here.
The most likely thing for the sorcerer to do would be to come in, buy a coffee, sit down, and send the email. There's no use panicking over other options unless this one doesn't pan out. Okay. He narrows down each file to the hour before the corresponding email was sent. It's still hundreds of names, so he sorts them alphabetically. Theoretically, he should appear on all three lists, he says. He emails one list to Derek and one to Scott, so they can pull them up on their phones and give him a hand. It's painstaking work, going through the lists for duplicates. There are a lot of names that appear on both of the first two lists, which isn't actually that surprising. Both of the first two emails were sent on a Saturday afternoon. There are plenty of people who stop in a coffee shop around the same time every week, on their way to or from work. The newest email, however, was sent on a Tuesday evening. Only a few people also appear on that list as well. Stiles marks down their names and keeps going, hoping he doesn't end up with more than half a dozen people to research. But in the end, there's only one, because he stumbles upon the name Sebastian Stone, and it strikes a chord with him. I know that name, he says, rubbing both hands over his face. It's the kind of name you don't forget. God, why do I know that name? Was it in one of the books you were reading? Derek asks. No, I don't. Stiles stands up abruptly and jogs out of the room. He grabs the folder of information that his father had gotten him on Dr. Deaton and comes back downstairs, flipping through it. Ah, found it! Okay, so one time Dr. Deaton ran away from home. This was when he was 15, not long before he got his shit together. There was a missing persons report filed, and it says here, last seen in the company of Sebastian Stone, foster brother, age 17. That sounds like our guy then, Allison says. Scott is looking at the folder in distaste. Why do you have that? Because I don't want to die, Scott, Stiles says, losing his temper. And I don't want any of you to die either. You didn't object when I pulled police reports on Callie or hacked Gerard's bank account. Get off the goddamn judgment train. Nobody here boarded with you. Callie and Gerard were enemies, Scott retorts. Dr. Deaton is a friend. He saved Derek's life. And you pulled up all this stuff about his private life, which was none of your business. Yeah, and because I did that, now I know the name of the actual enemy, and I can pull up stuff about his private life, which is none of my business. Stiles snaps back. The rest of the pack is shifting uncomfortably, uneasy with the sudden tension descending into the room. I never pretended to be a goddamned angel of morality, and you knew that when you accepted me as your alpha. You've known me longer than anyone in this room. You were there when I bribed the janitor not to tell my dad that he'd caught us on the roof trying pot. You were there when I started an entire business of writing papers for college students to buy the Jeep. You were there when I said, hey, there's a body in the woods. Let's go ace out my dad and find it first. You've never complained about my lack of morals when they benefited you. You know me, so don't pull this goody-two-shoes bullshit when there is someone in town trying to kill us. You want to make an issue out of this? Okay, we can make an issue out of it. But if you don't, then back the fuck down. Scott looks away, his jaw tight and angry, fists clenched at his sides. He nods, once, but then says, okay, fine, but don't act all surprised that I'm upset about this, because you know me too. Yeah, Stiles says wearily, the tension leaking away, leaving him drained and miserable. Nothing like a good dose of his wholesome, upstanding best friend to make him feel like the world's worst sociopath. Yeah, I know you. Silence sits for several long moments before Derek clears his throat and says, so, Sebastian Stone, what do we know about him? Nothing, Stiles says. We are going to do a broad sweep for information. Allison, I want you to call your dad. See if he's heard the name. I'm going to text Justin. He types in a few quick commands to his computer
and says, "Okay, there are only 9 Sebastian Stones in the United States. I'll see if my dad can dig anything up. We've also got his credit card information, so we can run that and see what comes up. That's the game plan." He sends a text to his father to give him the information, and is peripherally aware of Allison on the phone with her father while he types out a message to Justin. He receives a reply almost immediately this time, which reads,
"Holy shit, dude, what are you doing tangling with stone?"
Stiles is extremely glad that nobody is looking over his shoulder to see that message. He types back,
"I'm not. He's decided to tangle with me."
This time, there's a long pause.
"I won't lie, man. Stone is a serious A-lister warlock with big-time power. That much I've already gathered. Do you know any details?" "Sorry, no. He's more of a name and a reputation than anything else. But I'll ask the others and see if I can find anything out."
Stiles sighs and tucks his phone away. He gives Allison a questioning look, but her father's reaction was much the same as Justin's. He's heard of Stone, but doesn't know much about him. Unlike Justin, he doesn't want to ask around because he doesn't want to draw attention to Beacon Hills. Stiles appreciates the sentiment. Until his father gets him some actual information, he's out of luck. He's feeling restless, so he goes into the kitchen to make dinner. The others hang out in the living room, playing video games and cheering each other on. That's something else he has to think about. The full moon will be happening soon. He supposes that they'd be safe enough in their warehouse, but he wishes there was an easier solution. Without much else to do, he badgers everyone into doing their homework, so they won't have it hanging over their heads in case the weekend gets exciting or dangerous. It leads to a fairly quiet evening, although he constantly has to keep Erica on task. Schoolwork is not her forte. He suspects that whenever he leaves the room, she starts copying off Isaac, but doesn't actually care that much as long as the work gets done. They drift off to bed in twos and threes. Stiles lies in the center of the wolf pile and stares at the ceiling, restless and distracted. The waiting is the hardest part. Eventually, he drifts off. But for the first time in months, he dreams about the night he killed Peter. Dreams about holding the syringe in his hand, about pushing down the plunger. But when he looks up, it's not Peter anymore. He's shooting the poison into himself. He wakes with a start. There's obviously no point in trying to go back to sleep after that nightmare. So he crawls out of bed and goes downstairs. The house is mostly dark and quiet. But there's a light on in the living room. He walks in to find Scott on the sofa, watching SNL reruns with the volume turned down low. Scott looks up at him, then away. Stiles sits down on the sofa next to him, and they both stare at the television for a minute. "I'm scared," Stiles finally says, pulling his knees to his chest. "You're not wrong, you know, about the sort of person I can be. That sort of ends justify the means attitude. There are lines I won't cross, but it feels like every time something like that happens, that line gets pushed a little further out. And that eventually I will do something unforgivable." "Are you thinking about that poem?" Scott asks. "That purity of a soul on the edge thing?" "Yeah," Stiles says. "Me too," Scott says. Stiles hugs himself a little tighter. "What do you think? If our positions had been reversed, what would you have done? I mean, back last winter, if you were the one who had found Peter in the Urgent's basement." Scott lets out a breath. "I don't know, man. I know why you killed him, and I don't think you were wrong. Maybe that's the sort of thing you can never know about yourself until it actually happens. I think I could kill someone, if it were to protect Allison or to protect you. But I don't know that I could have done it like that. Cold." "Yeah," Stiles agrees. "I guess maybe I should just trust you to be my Jiminy Cricket and try not to freak out so much." Scott punches him in the shoulder. "I'm way cooler than Jiminy Cricket."
Okay, pal. Out of all the things you are, cool is not on the list, Styles says, and Scott laughs despite himself. Look, thanks for being willing to call me out. I'm not saying that I'm going to agree with you or back down, or even that I'll always think you're right. But somebody has to tell me when I'm getting too close to the line. So, thanks.
Whatever, jerk, Scott says, embarrassed. You say that like I'm white as snow.
You're not perfect, Styles says, but you're decent. And sometimes I think I'm going to need a reminder to be decent.
This only embarrasses Scott more, so he just turns the volume up on the TV without saying anything. And they're doing a particularly funny segment, so before long both of them are laughing. Styles falls asleep on the couch and wakes up several hours later to find himself covered with a blanket, and even tucked in. Damn Scott and his decency, anyway.
When Styles wakes up on the sofa, the others are up. He can hear them in the kitchen, so he must have slept fairly late. He pushes himself off the sofa, uses the bathroom, and goes in search of coffee. It's about 11 o'clock in the morning. He greets all his wolves and gets something to drink. Everyone is tense and edgy, and Styles knows he simply can't keep them all cooped up inside all day. It's a gorgeous autumn day, and it's getting close to the full moon. He still hasn't heard from any of his contacts, so there's no reason to stay in. So he gets dressed and says, "Come on, guys, let's go out in the woods for a bit." And the relief in the room is practically palpable. They climb the fence in the back of the yard and run for a bit, then organize an ultimate frisbee game. It's 3 o'clock before he gets a text from his father saying he's compiled all the information he can find. Does he want to come by the station, or should he just bring it home with him in the evening? Styles opts to go by the station and collect it. They split into two groups of four again. He thinks a pack of eight is a good number. Even, easy to split up. Half of them head back to Styles, while the other half head to the station. It's not a long trip, in any case. His father is dealing with a gang of college-aged delinquents who have been vandalizing downtown shops for the past 3 weeks. And he doesn't really have much time. He just gives Styles a stack of papers and another jump drive and says, "Be careful," before going back to his job. Styles drives back to Derek's and sits down with the life and times of Sebastian Stone. Like Dr. Deaton, it's a sad story, but a much more violent one. At the age of 6, his father murdered his mother and then turned the gun on himself. Sebastian sustained a gunshot wound to the stomach during the incident, but was saved at the hospital. His two younger siblings were not as lucky. His father actually did survive his self-inflicted gunshot wound, but went into a coma that lasted until he died 11 years later. Sebastian was put in foster care and, like Deaton, was bounced from home to home. Knowing that Stone is the actual enemy, Sheriff Stilinski has apparently dug a little deeper into his history than he did with Deaton. There are a few reports from CPS caseworkers included in the file, stating that Sebastian was a quiet child. The language is clean and professional, but Styles gets the impression that everyone involved was simply creeped out by him. He's moved several times because other people in the home suffered accidents. A little sister falls down the stairs. A family dog dies after ingesting rat poison. A mother's supply of medication goes missing, nearly causing her to suffer cardiac arrest. None of these incidents are ever tied directly to Sebastian, but it sets up a disturbing pattern. He also changes caseworkers several times. Styles isn't sure if that's normal or not, and out of curiosity gets on Google and starts looking up the names. It takes some intense searching, but he finds that two of his caseworkers died, one in a car accident and the other of an aneurysm. Both died not long after one of the other accidents. Most disturbing of all, the first was when Sebastian was only 8 years old. He runs away from foster homes 3 times. The third time is when he's 14, and it takes them over a month to find him. He starts blowing through foster homes in a matter of days, and is eventually placed in a juvenile detention facility for drug use. He spends 2 years there. When he leaves, he's placed in his last foster home, that of Jim and Judy Saunders, and there he stays. Stiles checks the dates. Stone was put in that foster home a month after Deaton, and for some reason chose to stay there. Since having a foster brother he seems to actually like is the only thing that has changed, Stiles assumes that Deaton is the reason. But then, 6 months later, both Deaton and Stone leave that home. Deaton is found 3 days later, according to his own files, and goes on to be homed with the veterinarian who helped him change his life. But Stone never turns up again. That's it for the CPS files and the police reports. Since that time, Stone has had no scrapes with the law, and there isn't a lot of other information. Stiles pushes his hands through his hair and starts going through the credit card records. It's a new card, opened only 4 months previous. There aren't any unusual purchases on it, and all of them are in Beacon Hills. That's creepy. It means that Stone was in town, watching them, for at least a month before he did anything. Stiles takes a map of Beacon Hills and hangs it on Derek's wall with thumbtacks. He circles the grocery store, the gas station, the electronics store, the pharmacy, where Stone has been making purchases. It narrows down the Warlock's probable location to about a 4-block radius. "Okay, boys and girls," he says, dropping a gigantic stack of newspapers onto this table. Thank God that his father is old-fashioned enough to read actual newspapers, and also lazy enough that he never bothers to take them to the recycling plant the way he always means to. Here's today's project. "This looks like a new definition of fun," Lydia says. "Well, you know me," Stiles says. "Stone first used his credit card in our sweet city of Beacon Hills on July 8th. I've narrowed down his location. So, what we're going to do is go through the real estate section of the classifieds and look for houses or apartments inside that radius that were available in late June, early July, but then unavailable later in August." He starts tossing out markers to everyone. "Set two!" It takes about an hour to narrow it down to two possibilities. One is a small house in a residential neighborhood. The other is the first two floors of an office building. They seem equally likely, but Stiles is leaning towards the office building. He just has this gut feeling that someone who did so poorly in homes as a child wouldn't want to live in a cute two-story with a white picket fence. By this time, it's getting late, and he decides to wait until the next day. Much of the literature he has read suggests that warlocks are stronger at night. Stone seems to be particularly nocturnal. Looking through his credit card records, there isn't a single purchase before noon, and the vast majority of them take place after 6 p.m. So Stiles makes popcorn, and they settle down with an Avengers movie marathon. Between Iron Man and Thor, an idea strikes him. He excuses himself and dials Dr. Deaton's number. He greets him courteously, not at all upset about being bothered on a Saturday night. "I have a question for you," Stiles says, "and if you can't answer it, that's fine. Just tell me that. If I were to be planning to confront a sorcerer on his home turf, would it be helpful to make a circle of mountain ash around the building before I entered?" There's a brief hesitation, and then Dr. Deaton says calmly, "No, a sorcerer would still be able to perform the spells within the circle. So if you were inside it with him, he would still be able to cast on you. If you were outside and he were inside, then yes, it would keep you protected from his magic." "Okie dokie," Stiles says. "Thanks for the intel." There goes that idea. He continues to ponder as they watch the movie. He begins to wonder what, exactly, his plan should be. What are they going to do to Stone once they find him? Will they be able to convince him to leave town? To reverse whatever spell he's done that affects the pack bond? Will threatening his life work again? Or will they have to kill him? So far, despite his formidable reputation, they've mostly been able to deal with opponents without actually killing them. Peter is the notable exception. The death of Cali might have been widely rumored to have been perpetuated by his pack, but that isn't true. The hunters that have died on his territory, without exception, were killed either by Peter or by members of the Alpha Pack. Two packs have tried to take his territory, one with an Alpha, and one a group of Betas that wanted to kill him to gain an Alpha. While it's true that Styles and his pack gave them a fair bit more than bloody noses, nobody was actually killed that he knows of. But the problem here is that those wolves could be reasoned with. They weren't insane like Peter or sociopathic like Cali. They were able to look at Styles and his pack, conduct a risk-reward assessment, and beat feet when it became clear that winning would carry too great a price. Sebastian Stone seems to be someone else that he will not be able to reason with. He's in this for the game, for the fun. He won't leave until it's become clear that he's lost. And so far, Styles has nothing with which he can force his hand. He calls Dr. Deaton again. Magical oaths. Real or not real? Real, Deaton says. If a sorcerer swears something on his power, breaking that oath can cripple him. Are there ways to strip away a sorcerer's power? There's a slight hesitation. Then Dr. Deaton says, I'm sorry. That's one I can't answer. Okay, Styles says, taking this as a yes. He hangs up and rethinks his strategy. Maybe it would be better to try to go to the apartment while Stone isn't there. If they can find whatever he's using to manipulate the pack bond, they could end the spell without having to confront him directly. It's an appealing idea, but he suspects it won't work. Stone had turned up when they came to his hotel. He'll probably know the instant they set foot on his territory again. One way or another, they'll come into contact with him. So if they go while he's theoretically asleep, if they're quiet and stealthy, it might be possible to get him inside a circle of ash. Then they might be able to extort some sort of promise about leaving town. Magic won't go through the circle, but bullets and arrows will. Sleep isn't even an option. He's up all night, searching public records to find a blueprint of the office and research in his magic books about the sort of phrasing that would be used in a magically binding promise. He doesn't want to encounter any of the "you didn't say Simon says" bullshit that magic seems to be rife with. He divides their remaining mountain ash into little Ziploc bags and wakes everyone at dawn. The office building is one of the older parts of town, and a lot of the buildings around it are empty. Styles becomes even more certain that this is the right place. He doesn't want to kick the door down if he doesn't have to, but it takes him almost 10 minutes to jimmy it with a credit card and a butter knife. He's starting to think they'll have to look for a window before it finally opens. Fortunately, no one else is around. The first floor of the offices are completely empty, except for a few pieces of furniture. There's a desk in the main room, and then two back rooms, one of which has another desk and two rickety chairs, the other of which has a conference table and no chairs at all. Everything is coated with a thin layer of dust, except the floor. Towards the back, there's a narrow staircase. Styles leaves Boyd and Erica downstairs, and designates Isaac and Lydia as exit guards, one at the front and one at a door that leads out into the alley. Derek and Scott pad up the stairs in their wolf forms, while Allison plays rear guard. He eases the door to the second floor open, and they edge inside. It looks much like the hotel room, although marginally better organized. Parts of the apartment are obviously being used for purposes other than magic. There are dirty dishes in the sink, and a television with a DVD player, and an armchair in one corner. But at the center of the room, there's a card table with what looks like a spiderweb made out of red string sitting on it. Styles takes a few steps closer. The web is strung up between several nails. Attached to each one is a photograph of a pack member. His own photograph is pinned down at the center. More representational magic. And the cause of the disruption to the pack bond is easy to see. There's more of that black goo, although it's a little more solid this time, looking almost like mold or a fungus. It appears to be growing on the web itself, gnawing away at the strands that connect them all. The entire thing is nailed down to a piece of wood, and it looks bulky to try to get it down the stairs without anyone noticing. Styles snaps a quick photograph and turns away from it for the moment. He gestures towards the hallway. Allison nods and goes down, her bow held at the ready. She opens the door to the bathroom and signals that it's empty. Then, the bedroom, also empty. "Not here," Styles says, and lets out a breath. It makes things easier for the moment, but in the long run, it leaves the ball in Stone's court, which is where Styles absolutely does not want it. He's not very good at playing defense. They could stake the place out, waiting for him to come back. He wonders about making a circle of mountain ash just inside the room, if they could trick him into stepping into it. It seems unlikely. He goes back over the web and gently touches a string. An unpleasant feeling shudders through him, like someone had walked over his grave. He sees the others flinch too, but theoretically, they should be able to purify this and end the spell the same way that Deaton had purified the voodoo doll. "It is a masterpiece, isn't it?" Sebastian's voice says. Like before, he comes from nowhere, but this time, in the light of the apartment, they can see him clearly. He looks so nondescript that Styles is strangely disappointed. Medium height, medium build, he seems to be medium everything. His hair is black, cut in a typical men's style with bangs swept to one side. He's wearing jeans and a button-down shirt with the sleeves rolled up. "I like it," Styles agrees. "Very avant-garde." He's aware of both Scott and Derek growling, but it's peripheral, unimportant. Stone is here for him. He'll view the wolves as an extension of Styles' power. "Not so sure about the photos, though. They seem a little tacky." "A lock of each pack member's hair would have worked better," Stone agrees. "With that, I could have destroyed your pack entirely."
"Gee, it's a good thing that none of us have seen the barber lately," Styles quips. "I bet he's on your payroll."
He looks over his shoulder at Allison and says,
"I guess you gals were right about me growing up my hair all along."
"Happy to be of service," Allison says. Her arm never trembles as she keeps the arrow trained on Stone. "So," Stone says, "what's your plan? I assume you do have a plan."
"Well, my plan is for you to swear an oath on your power to leave Beacon Hills, never return, and never lay a magical, physical, verbal, etc. finger on my pack ever again," Styles says. "I'm a little fuzzy on the details, but sometimes I just play by ear. What do you think would be most threatening in this situation? Thumbscrews? That's what I'm leaning towards now."
"Very intimidating," Stone says. "And you did find me here, which is, of course, impressive. But there's an angle you haven't considered yet." He jerks his wrist a little, and a knife slides out of his sleeve and into his hand. It's not a particularly scary-looking knife, only about 4 inches long, but he doesn't brandish it toward Styles. Instead, he slides it underneath one strand of red thread and presses the edge of the blade against it. Styles feels that pressure. It's like someone is applying a chokehold to him. He has to remind himself to breathe. "Don't you dare!" Stone grins at him, a grin that's all tooth, despite the lack of wolf underneath the skin.
"And how will you stop me?"
Styles isn't aware of the decision to draw his 38. It's just suddenly in his hand and pointed right at Stone's chest. His aim is good, but not perfect, and he would prefer to have a more solid target than to attempt a headshot.
"I could just shoot you."
"You could," Stone agrees. "But you should know that I've secured documents that will be released in the event of my untimely demise. You're heavily implicated. I imagine that would reflect very poorly on your father, would it not?
Only if they find your body, Stiles says.
Stone laughs outright at that. Touché, he says, but then leans across the web, right in Stiles' face. But would you? Would you? When you still have nightmares about killing Peter Hale? Stiles blanches and takes a step back automatically. But before any smart retort can come to his lips, Stone is knocked off his feet by a mass of dark, snarling fur. Derek has been using the time during their little chat to circle low around the table. At that, he lunges forward. Stone hits the ground, but there's a bright flash of power, almost ultraviolet light, and he's flung backwards. The sorcerer gets to his feet, and Stiles hears the twang of Allison's bow. He tunes it out because he has to tune it out, because he has to deal with the web. He fishes in his pocket and pulls out the Sharpie that he was circling real estate ads with the previous day. It's a good thing he hadn't bothered to change clothes. Then he draws a circle on the card table around the piece of wood. It's not as good as a salt circle or a copper circle, according to his reading, but it's got to be better than nothing. It's going to work because it has to work. He grabs his phone out of the other pocket and plays the recording of Dr. Deaton's voice as he purified the doll. Stone reacts as though he had been struck by lightning. His head jerks up and around, but Stiles barely notices. He places the tips of his fingers on the circle and starts reciting the words along with Deaton. He focuses all his thought, all his willpower, all his belief into the circle. He says the words over and over again, ignoring the snarling, the crashes, the cries of pain that are going on around him. There's another flash of light, this one brilliant crimson, and Stiles is flung backwards and away from the circle. He hits the wall hard, and everything goes mercifully dark.